There's one other thing I want to do with scene one before we move on to the longer and more complicated scene two. I was talking about the nature of Horatio as a Stoic and being very influenced by classical philosophy and the classical vision. Let me just underscore that. We know the ghost has been roaming the battlements, and Horatio says, yes, there's a reason to be concerned about this. This is about line 115 of the very first scene. It's on page 4 of the Dover text. Horatio's speech at the bottom of the page there. A mote it is to trouble the mind's eye. In the most high and palmy state of Rome, a little ere the mightiest Julius fell, the graves stood tenantless, and the sheeted dead did squeak and gibber in the Roman streets. Okay? Then he goes on to talk about other disasters that occurred. He's been reading his classical history. It is consistent with Horatio's character. You will find there are other references to Julius Caesar in this play because Shakespeare had probably just finished writing his Julius Caesar. It was still on his mind. In fact, there's a little theater joke that we'll notice later. But the ghost then reappears, and I think it's of course interesting that we get that classical vision, and then the ghost having appeared, and then it goes off again without speaking. Later in the same scene, Horatio makes another claim. This is about line 150, the page 6 of the Dover text. Bernardo says, it was about to speak when the cock crew. They have the sense that ghost was about to tell them something. The cock crew and the ghost faded. Horatio, and then it started like a guilty thing upon a fearful summons, which raises a question about the ghost, although this is just an impression of Horatio's. I have heard the cock, that is the trumpet to the morn, doth with his lofty and shrill sounding throat awake the god of day. And at his warning, whether in sea or fire, in earth or air, the extravagant and erring spirit hies to his confine. Though the truth here in this present object made probation, Horatio's starting to doubt his own doubt. Assumption being, well, there's really nothing spiritual, I'm a Stoic, but now wait, this ghost is walking around, and I've heard it said that when the cock crows, the god of day is awakened, and then the spirits have to go to their confines, but please notice we're talking classical still, the god of day. This is very much a classical vision. Then comes the great and famous speech, and it's given to Marcellus. It faded on the crowing of the cock. Some say that ever against that season comes wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated, this bird of dawning singeth all night long. And then they say, no spirit dare stir abroad. The nights are wholesome. Then no planet strikes, no fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is that time. Contradictory view. Horatio gives the classical view, but even then, tentatively, I have heard, he says. I have heard. Marcellus contradicts Horatio by saying, some say that, but gives the vision and talks about the day of Christ's birth. And we get the, if you will, the two sides, two different visions of what the crowing of the cock means. And then Horatio says, so have I heard and do in part believe it. Well, maybe there's something to that Christian business. But please notice, everything in the scene is either I have heard that or some say. And Horatio will go as far as to say, I do in part believe it. We're talking everything secondhand and tentative. No clear, we're just in the first scene, and this is conversation of soldiers on the battlement. Can't be taken for, you know, high philosophical analysis. But my point is, even the soldiers talking on the battlement, well, I've heard that, well, some say, well, I think this, well, I kind of believe it, I guess, maybe, sort of. This whole world that's being presented here from the beginning is a world of uncertainty. How do we know? And if we know something, do we really know it? And if we believe anything, do we really believe it? And how far do we believe it? And, well, maybe I doubt it because I've heard this and I'm not sure and I don't know. And that's in the first scene with just the soldiers. Now, as we move into scene two, very simple point. Very simple point. Shakespeare was working on a single stage. This would have been staged at the Globe. We didn't have scenery. We had a permanent structure, okay? Permanent structure to the playhouse. With a thrust stage that came out, the audience seated either in those tiers of balconies three quarters of the way around, or the groundlings who paid a penny to get in standing in the pit looking up at the stage, okay? Probably yelling and commenting all through it. So that everybody was there, the whole social order was there. One thing I do commend Shakespeare and love for is they capture that sense of Elizabethan theater. It was turbulent, exciting, and everybody turned out. The one anachronism is that the Queen would not have shown up at the playhouse. No. She would summon the players and they'd go to her. But it makes a grand moment when she suddenly appears in the playhouse and walks down. But, nevertheless, Shakespeare can use setting to his own purpose and advantage, and all great playwrights tell us something about what they are thinking by the progression of scenes. And as I said, there's not a lot of change here, but there are things that we can still get a sense of, and the very movement from the battlements of the castle, the ramparts of the castle, and the guard outside to a council chamber room inside sets up in the first two scenes one of the problems of the play, which is exterior-interior. What's going on outside? What's going on inside? What about those soldiers and what they're talking about and what they're watching for on the battlements? That is the warriors and what's happening inside with the politicians and the personal life. And is there any connection between the two? A play, this question the play raises consistently is, can we judge what's inside via externals? And that gets expressed in the famous question that haunts this play, is Hamlet really mad or is he just pretending to be mad? And how can we know? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I'll mention it briefly, but again, that question, and it's a valid question, you can explore it, and insofar as how far is this young man pushed? And what is the effect on his mental state? But the larger question, what is the connection between the outside, what we're seeing, and what's really going on inside, and how can we know? And it is everywhere in the play, from his treatment of Polonius to the soliloquy. What is the gap between what the court of Denmark is seeing and what we're seeing or hearing when he soliloquizes? Outside, inside. Battlements, interior of the castle. External, internal. And we get it in the first two scenes as part of the design. I mentioned yesterday my friend who had the chance to play Claudius to the Keanu Reeves Hamlet and passed it up. Let me just say this. This is of some interest. Claudius's first speech is an actor's nightmare. It is well known in the theater as being one of the most difficult speeches, not just to deliver, but to try to memorize. I don't want to go through it in detail, but please do notice the beginning of it. The first sentence is seven lines long. Listen to this and try to follow it. Though yet of Hamlet, our dear brother's death, the memory be green, and that it us be fitted to bear our hearts in grief, and our whole kingdom to be contracted in one brow of woe, yet so far hath discretion fought with nature that we with wisest sorrow think on him together with remembrance of ourselves. Not easy to memorize. You can sort through it if you've got the text in front of you. You're about to walk out on a stage, and those are your opening lines. Okay? And that's after we've had action and ghosts, okay? Therefore, our sometime sister, now our queen, the imperial jointress to this warlike state, have we, as 'twere with a defeated joy, with an auspicious and a drooping eye, with mirth in funeral and with dirge in marriage, in equal scale weighing delight and dole, taken to wife. Now, again, we can figure out what he's saying. Once you understand it, it's clear, but we're talking the stage. And what are we getting? We're getting words. We're getting words that mean what they're saying, but they're difficult to break through. We've got a politician here. We have a politician here. And if ever accused of saying, well, I didn't get what you meant, he can say, well, it's perfectly clear. I said, but as you go through the words are not helping you toward a meaning. We have a master politician here. Well, that depends upon what the definition of is, okay? Now, I'm not going to go through the rest of the speech, but it is a long, difficult, and why is that? Well, perhaps, as with most politicians, he's a little uneasy about something, and is so making a grand public statement in which we're not quite sure what he's saying, but it sure sounds formal. It sure sounds important, and I guess things are... And please notice, that speech is 39 lines long. Whew. We get into the politics. I'm not going through it again. I mentioned it of young Fortinbras, okay? I won't go through the details, but I will say this. Please notice from the start the play's construction. The play's construction. This is one of the problems in staging it complete, and it's one of the reasons why it is so long and complex. We have Hamlet, our hero, whose uncle has become the king and has replaced his father, old Hamlet. We have young Fortinbras, nephew to the king of Norway, who has replaced the dead father, old Fortinbras. Between Denmark and Norway, we have an exact parallel. And the contrast between young Hamlet and young Fortinbras is there throughout the play, and it is emphasized by the other parallels. We have a king in charge who has just replaced another king, and that old king has the same name as the young prince. But we have very different circumstances. And then, of course, we have, within the court of Denmark, young Laertes, with his father, Polonius, chief counsel to the state. We have another father-son relationship that is also problematic, as we're going to find out very soon. Okay? We have three young men in the play, not one. We have young Hamlet, young Fortinbras, young Laertes. And we have real either father or parental figure problems. Young Hamlet with Claudius. Young Fortinbras with his uncle who's on the throne, who's troubled because I didn't know the kid was raising arms to fight against Denmark. I thought he was going over to Poland. What's this kid up to? I gotta put the lid on him. Okay? We have youth that has to be controlled by age. Question is, who's doing the controlling? What are these kids up to? We have generational conflict. We have generational conflict, okay? That political level is often dispensed with. It's hugely important. This is, on one level, a play about politics and how politics intrude into the personal. And, of course, those connections have to do with larger ideas in terms of what we know about life and how we understand our position in it. But if you get rid of the political, as the Gibson movie does, you're losing a whole sphere of this play. It's extremely important. Denmark fears war. And that's a very real problem. Okay? And it's being worked on there. Now, please notice, as soon as we send off the ambassadors to deal with young Fortinbras, who seems to be making problems, line about 41, the king turns and says, and now, Laertes, what's the news with you? We've got another young man that has to be dealt with. You told us of some suit. What is it, Laertes? Okay. Now, what's your problem, kid? I've got that Norwegian kid I've got to deal with. Now, you know, he's very polite. It's important. We went through this. And the question is, Laertes says, I want to go back to France. And the permission is given through the approval of the father. Okay, the father figure again. And then he turns to deal with the third young man. Okay, notice the opening of scene two. We've got the newly installed king who's got these young men to deal with. We've got a political problem, young Fortinbras. We've got a personal question, young Laertes. And now we've got young Hamlet. But now, my cousin Hamlet and my son, and there's the problem right there, okay? You're my nephew, cousin in the sense of close relative. You're my nephew, and now you're also my son. And we get the first wonderful pun, a little more than kin and less than kind. Yeah, we're not just kinfolk, we're double kinfolk now. We're just not ordinary kin. We're a lot of kin. You're my uncle, you're my stepfather, and less than kind, but you're nothing like me, buddy. We may have lots of family ties, but we've got nothing in common. But notice the first line. What do we get from the beginning? A brilliantly constructed, witty remark. The balance between kin and kind. The balance between more and less. We get in the very first line the intelligence, the balance, the wit, and after all this political talk, Claudius the politician, we get something that Gertrude will say later, brevity is the soul of wit, you know, okay? Thank goodness, there it is. And here it is, this is the soul of wit. This is brilliant. The king, how is it that the clouds still hang on you? Not so, my lord, I am too much in the sun. Second zinger. Your royal radiant presence is burning me. And also, no, I'm too much of a son. I've got two fathers now. Second zinger. Simply, he's tossing off one-liners. It is part of the appeal of the character right from the beginning. But please notice, this is a public political occasion. Zap, zap. The queen steps in and makes the point, we know you loved your father, but that this just happens, it's common, everything that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. I, madam, it is common. The word is thrown at her. I can't analyze every line, I wish I could, but It is not a witty remark. It is simply taking the queen's word and tossing it back at her in not a friendly or appropriately son-like way. If it be, why seems it so particular with thee? And then we get the beginning of another idea that's running throughout the play. Seems, madam, nay, it is. I know not seems. And here is the beginning of that whole question of appearance and reality. What's real, and how can we know it's real, and again, external and internal, okay? Don't talk about seeming. It's not something that's seeming. It is. It's real. What you're seeing on the outside connects with what's on the inside. And it is not appearance, it is reality. It is not a low my inky cloak, good mother. And it's very rare. Shakespeare gives a costume direction. Hamlet has to be wearing a black cloak. He doesn't often do this. He'll occasionally write in a stage direction. He will occasionally write in a costume. This is what I want. You make sure you get it. And Hamlet has to be in black. But of course, notice what? A black cloak. Well, the whole point of a cloak is to cover something up. So the costume is fighting what's being said. No, it's not seems, it's not an appearance. I am. I'm open and forthright, he says as he wears his black cloak and draws it about him. We've got contradictions in the costuming before the play begins. You know, we're barely started. The point I'm trying to make in all this is it's just puzzle on puzzle on puzzle, and it's not easy to sort out. I'm not going to go through his whole response, okay? But I will, at the very end of that speech, says, these indeed seem, that is, there can be outward seeming, for they are actions that a man might play. I need to emphasize that because the whole Hamlet problem, in a nutshell, is why doesn't he act sooner? If the ghost tells him what to do in Act 1, why does it take till Act 5 before he gets around to it? The Hamlet problem is the problem of action. Why doesn't he do what he was told to do? Now, that encompasses a lot of ground, and there is not a quick or easy answer. But here, he himself raises the idea of action, and in his first comment on action, he suggests that actions are parts that can be played, moods or emotions that can be played, and we get into acting right from the beginning. Please notice, these concepts are here from the start, and Shakespeare is playing with them. There's a reason they come up later, and there's a reason why they are problematical. They are actions that a man might play. And we're going to have the players, we're going to have acting, all that's going to come on later. But I have that within which passes show. These but the trappings and the suits of woe. And now he does make a distinction. Yeah, you're seeing something outside. This is mourning. This is a son mourning for his father. But inside, I have something that surpasses these external signs of woe. There's something even more profound going on inside, and now we do have the distinction. There's something more inside than what can be seen outside. Now, another long speech by Claudius. I'm not going through it, but basically saying every son loses his father. It's part of nature. And if you pretend, if you are going on too much about it, it is a fault against the dead, a fault to heaven, a fault to nature, and against reason. We get the stepfather reprimanding the stepson. Before anything has happened, there is real tension between the two characters. Let me just say simply, in plot terms, and I'm going back to Aristotle, we have our protagonist, Hamlet. We have our antagonist, Claudius. That's the major opposition in the play, just speaking in terms of action and plot. This play is about Hamlet versus Claudius. They're the two big major figures. Clearly, as I said with Oedipus, there is a sense in which Hamlet's also fighting himself. That goes on throughout the play. But in terms of the action which is there, it is Hamlet versus Claudius, and it's clear right here, and he is accusing the boy of being too adolescent, over-emotional, and then says, think of us as of a father, okay? You are the most immediate to the throne. However, for your intent in going back to school in Wittenberg, it is most retrograde to our desire, and we beseech you, bend you to remain here in the cheer and comfort of our eye, our chiefest courtier, cousin, and our son. Why doesn't he want him going back? Again, this is a huge question, and this is emphasized by what? Laertes just came and said, I was here for the king's funeral, I want to go back to France. Is it okay with your father? It's fine with him, go back to France. Hamlet, I came from Wittenberg, I want to go back to school. Absolutely not. It's against our wish. No reason is given. But the pseudo-father, the stepfather says, uh-uh, you're staying in the court. There can only be one possible reason. Mistrust. Mistrust. Before anything happens, I want you around, I want to keep an eye on you. By act four of the play, Claudius is going to be glad to send him off, but not back to school. Off to England to be put to death. It's the only way I can deal with him. He's out of here, but he's out of life as well. I want him off the planet. I'm not just out of the court, I want him out of my life. I want him out of all life. At this point, I want him around. And then his mother prays that he will also stay. And the response is, I shall in all my best obey you, madam. Oh, slap. You want me to do that, mother? Then all right, I'll obey you, madam. But notice, double slap, not just a slap against the king. I don't care what the king wants, but if you want me to do that, then I'll stay. But it's not, I will obey you, mother. It's, I will obey you, madam. Deliberate word choice. We have teenage rebellion. Okay, this scene has been acted out a million times since by teenagers dealing with their parents. We have rebellion. We have the angry adolescent who is smart and has a smart mouth and is showing off to his parents. And you know that once they leave this council chamber, what they're saying to each other is, what are we going to do with this kid? And there seems to be genuine concern, obviously more on the part of Claudius for a very real reason, but his mother's concern seems to be genuine. We are again in that, we've got a rebel who will soon have a cause. But I'm back to that romantic notion of the teenager, the rebellious teenager. Here it is. You can search all of Western literature and not find this. It is part of the dawn of the modern world, 1600. It's in this play. You go back through your Chaucer and your Dante and your Greeks and your Virgil and find me a smart-mouthed, quick-witted, rebellious teenager. Not going to find one. Since then, I can show you hundreds of them. It's become a standard literary, artistic type. Here is its beginning. But it begins not without cause. Okay? Little joke I made. This is a rebel with a cause. He doesn't yet know what's going on, but he's smart enough to know there's something wrong here at the court. The very soldiers on the battlements know it. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark. That comes from a soldier. Everybody around the court knows something is really wrong here, even if they don't know what. Which means there is a cause for this discomfort. There is a cause for this upset. They leave. We get the first soliloquy. We'll do it poetically this afternoon. What I'm doing here, and I'm going to go through it very carefully, is look at what he's saying. This is the first time the character opens up to us. We have some sense of who he is from that exchange with Claudius and his mother, but the whole point of a soliloquy is we are allowed to go into the interior of a character. The character is alone. The character is speaking his thoughts. So that this is the first time we get inside Hamlet, if you will, and this is hugely important. I need to go through it in close detail. I'm going to take it apart piece by piece. Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. I'll stop there. This is one of the cruxes for a poor editor who's editing the play. We have two or three, we have alternate readings of a word or two to the scholars, God bless them, who do good work. I was mentioning to a few folks just now that there are indeed people who have devoted their whole careers to trying to figure out one small textual problem in a Shakespeare play. I couldn't do it. I'd go nuts. But honorable men have devoted their lives to this, and it is of interest, and many of them have done good work, and they are to be commended. It means an obsession with detail, and looking at small details, and trying to reason out what something should be. Question here is the word solid? Is the word sullied? Is the word sallied? Most texts you'll find now print sullied. Okay? Which means dirty. Okay. I personally, maybe it's because I got to know it first, I'm one who goes with solid. I'll just make a little argument here. What the wish is, if we go inside Hamlet and he's wishing for something. He's wishing for a change in his being. Now, whether it's dirty flesh or solid flesh, doesn't matter. He wants it to change. If it's dirty, he wants it to become clean. He wants it to melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. If the flesh is dirty, dew is that small liquid on the grass in the morning. It is pure water. So if you take sullied, we're going from dirt to clean water. And that makes sense. Okay? If we take solid, this tutu solid flesh, melting, thawing, resolving itself from a dew, we're going from substance that is compact and hard to that which loses its existence until it is down to a single drop of dew, and then the sun does what? Evaporates it. We're going from hard, strong permanence, solidity, to nothingness. They both make sense in a way. We should have both of them there. It's an interesting problem. I won't say any more about it other than this. What we have, if we can't decide the two, is one thing. He wants who he is and what he is to change. And he wants it either cleaned up or gone. Or gone. Melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. And please notice the little joke. Goodbye. Adieu. French word for so long. He cannot help but be witty as he speaks. So the second line, he wishes that he would no longer be there and that he could resolve himself into adieu. These little moments are everywhere. It's what I talk about, the Shakespeare pun. Every Shakespeare pun is always there, obviously. He intended it. He was the master wordsmith, okay? I wish I could just leave this world, be gone. I wish I didn't exist anymore. Or, because the first two lines are simply a physical vanishing. Or, that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. If only God had not forbidden suicide. If only I could just go up to the battlements and jump off. If only I could just take one of those poignards and run myself through. If only I could get out of this by suicide, but I can't. Why not? Because there is the everlasting. He has given us his law, and his law says no. This is where Hamlet begins. He is not at this moment a stoic like Horatio. He is not at this moment a complete doubter. He says there are certain laws that God gave us that must be obeyed. This is a starting point for him, and this is hugely important. I wish I didn't exist, but since I do exist, I wish I could kill myself, but I can't kill myself because God says no. And to emphasize it, notice the end of the fourth line of the soliloquy. Oh, God! God! And he cries out. It is a call of pain, but it is consistent with that vision of the everlasting. And he calls out. But then he extends his vision, trapped in person, trapped in time, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable. It's a wonderful line. We'll talk about this afternoon. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Seems, madam? I know not seems. Wait a minute. Look at the word. It just reappeared. And now, all the uses of the world seem to him. Well, are they or not? That's a 20-minute discussion. We don't have time now. Every word in this play, every word becomes a problem. Every word connects with everything else. The point being, all the uses of the world seem to him to be pointless. Before he meets the ghost, before the ghost tells him to do anything, he is already saying, there's no point in doing anything in this world. All the uses of this world are weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable. This is before he's given a mission. This is extremely important. The problem exists before the encounter with the ghost. I would emphasize the problem is coming from the doubts expressed in that letter to Ophelia. The problem is a larger problem of faith and belief. Now, he's saying it's there. God said, I can't commit suicide, I can't commit suicide. But now there is the sense of, but I can't do anything either. I can't act. Everything in the world just seems pointless. Fie on it! A fie! 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. The world is a garden, but it's not paradise. It's not the Garden of Eden. It is not even one of those English gardens that's nicely trimmed and everything is well. No, it's an unweeded garden where everything grows to seed. Notice the phrase. If you have a garden where everything is seeding, what is happening? There is so much abundant life and growth that it's out of control. It will eventually choke itself. But you have too much life. The problem is what? The problem is seed. The problem is life. The problem is there's no weeding. The weeds are just springing up like crazy. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. The problem with the garden, which is the world, is that the weeds are taking over and they're producing seed like crazy and they are rank and gross. There's life. There are things happening. But it's all the rotten stuff. It's the weeds. There's no room for the flowers. The beauty is choked out. That it should come to this. Now, what is this? Now, all of this has been an abstraction. We don't know what he's talking about. Okay? Theater goer turns to other theater goers standing in the pit at the first performance and says, what's this guy's problem? We don't know yet. We haven't been told. We're about to be told. But 2 months dead. Oh, okay. It is the problem that Dad's dead. But 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. We get a correction. Dad's been dead 2 months. No, he hasn't even been dead 2 months. Time shrinkage. Watch time vanish in this play. Watch time vanish in this soliloquy. So excellent a king. Not so excellent a father. Please notice the first reference to Hamlet. Old Hamlet, a king. First reference is to the royal figure. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr. What does it mean? It means the dead king is to the new king as Hyperion, the god Apollo, is to a goat-like figure. Okay? Old King Hamlet, the sun god, new King Claudius, filthy goat-like man. He draws the comparison. His father is godlike, and not just any god, the sun god himself. So that first problem, we had an excellent king. We had a god for a king, and now we've got a goat. But of course, the goat, the very image and the image of the satyr, connects with lechery. We're back to that seed. We're back to that seed that is just growing in abundance, and now it's made clear. Talking about his father again, so loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Beautiful poetry, beautiful poetry. He loved her so much that he wouldn't have the very winds of heaven come and be too rough. When they would blow on her, he seems to have godlike powers. Hamlet's father is a king and a god. All right? Heaven and earth must I remember. He doesn't even want to think of it, but please notice, heaven and earth, the two are linked. They're going to be linked all the way through this play. Why she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. And now the focus shifts away from the greatness of the father to the love of Hamlet's mother for the king. And the image is of the mother hanging on the king and loving him so much, but it's an appetite image, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. But what is being fed on is love. So it's appropriate. And it's marital love. So even if the image is of appetite, it's not wrong, but it gives the sense of love, but not just love, love as physical appetite. And we're learning something about Gertrude right from the start. That's going to become a problem here before we even end the soliloquy. But there was something appropriate about the nature of her love when she loved the dead King Hamlet. Why she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet within a month, now wait a minute, it was 2 months. Nay, not so much not two, and now it's what? Just a month. Is he deliberately changing the amount of time, or is he being more honest about the amount of time? Can he not deal with the fact that the marriage occurred that fast? And now he's being more honest, and it was within a month. Father dies, mother remarries within a month? That really does look pretty strange. And yet within a month, let me not think on it, okay? We're back to heaven and earth, must I remember? This most thoughtful of all characters in his first soliloquy is saying, I don't want to think. I don't want to remember. I don't want to think. He's going to talk more and think more than any other character in all of literature. But he doesn't want to because he knows where it's leading. Let me not think on it. Frailty, thy name is woman. It seems to be an accusation. The fact of the matter is women are frail, but he's not speaking physically. He's speaking morally and emotionally. That's the nature of the frailty. Notice the next words. A little month. It wasn't even within a month. It wasn't even a full month. Now what, February? Short month? 3 weeks maybe? We seem to be getting more and more of an admission of how fast this event happened. A little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body like Niobe, all tears. Why, she, oh God, a beast that wants discourse of reason, would have married longer, married with my uncle. The question that often comes up, what is Hamlet's problem at the beginning of the play? Claudius thinks it's the death of his father. His mother thinks it's the death of his father. And yes, the death of his father has upset him because he was a great king. He was godlike. But please notice what we get here is an obsession with what his mother has done. The focus of this soliloquy is not on the death of his father. The focus of the soliloquy is on his mother's hasty remarriage. This is what's bothering him. Married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. We get another comparison. Remember the first one? Father, king, like sun god. Uncle, king, like goat man. Now we get another one, okay? Father, like Hercules. Okay? Excuse me. Father, not at all like uncle. Hercules, not at all like me. It's a very strange comparison. I have no more connection to Hercules than my uncle had to my father, because my father's like Hercules. I'm crappy and crummy like my uncle? Woo. This is one of those things that we should draw equations on the board. Who says poetry isn't mathematical? But we get the double equations in this soliloquy. They're both there. And what do we learn from both of them? My father is great. My father is great. A god, Hercules. My uncle is awful. My uncle is rotten. So am I. And we do get that connection between uncle and father. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Oedipal theory. It's nearly killed, it's strangled this play for most of this century. But you do see where it comes from. the claim made by an artist named Ernst Jones, who in a book called Hamlet and Oedipus, claiming that Hamlet's problem is his uncle has done what he wanted to do, kill his father and marry his mother, and therefore he's like Oedipus. No. And play solved. Now there is a tension in his relationship with his father, with his uncle, and with his mother. No doubt about that. Those tensions are there. To make them that reductive and simplistic is to ruin the all-encompassing grand drama of the play. There are tensions there, they're real. But this is not a play that needs a solution. This is not a hero that can be put on a couch and in a couple of counseling sessions given psychiatric clearance, and we can then dismiss the play. We've got it. It doesn't work that way. You would pluck out the heart of my mystery, and that's the proper response to Ernst Jones in his little book, Hamlet and Oedipus. Okay? But there is something there. No more like my father than I to Hercules. And he goes on. I'll rush through this. Within a month, ere yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married. And now it's within a month. Okay, now it's within a month. Oh, most wicked speed, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It was too fast, and that was viewed as incest at the time. For a woman to marry the brother of her dead husband was viewed as incest. So that word is used with precision. And that's part of what is clearly disturbing him. It was that fast, and it was an incestuous marriage. And it was with this awful man when she had that great man before. And this is wonderful poetry. Listen to the sounds. I don't have time to analyze it, but we'll do it this afternoon. Oh, most wicked speed, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. To say it involves an amount of saliva that is almost as gross as the depiction, as the idea that's being depicted. It's just awful. Just awful line. Great poetry. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. What is it? The marriage. The problem is his mother's marriage. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. I've got to shut up. Externally, I can say nothing. Inwardly, I am in horrific pain. This is before we know anything. Question, is there still something wrong? Yes, there seems to be. There has been an inappropriate emotional response on the part of his mother. His mother has done something that is so deeply troubling, he cannot grasp it. It does not make sense within his universe. Why is this such a big problem? Please think back to that little poem. Doubt that the stars are fire. Doubt that the sun doth move. Doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love. What is the one thing he's been holding on to that he believes in that he doesn't have to doubt? Love. His love for Ophelia. A young man's love for a woman, and this isn't Freudian, this is just common sense. An ability of a man to love comes from his vision of his parents' marriage and the love that is there. That is simple, straightforward. We grow up and learn to love by watching the love that is in the home as we grow up. If Hamlet has written to Ophelia from Wittenberg and said, I'm doubting everything, but never doubt my love. My love is solid. Love is real. I believe in love. What happens when he comes home? Oh, maybe there's no love. Oh. Appetite, seed, gardens, incestuous sheets. Oh man, is that all there is? Is that what mom has been about? What his mother has done is not high philosophical, intellectual problems that he got at the university. He's come home from the university and we've got a real domestic problem that has to do with the question, did my mother ever love my father? And if she didn't, if it was all show, If it was just animal appetite, and now she'll move from this guy to this guy, because you got to have a man around. Is there only appetite? Is there no such thing as love either? Having posed the question, in come the guards and say, we just saw your father on the battlements. Whew. I'm skipping over all of that, okay? I'm skipping over all of that. I hate to do so, but I'm doing it for this reason. Let's just go to his Hamlet's lines at the end of the scene. It's basically Hamlet saying, oh, I thought something was wrong. Well, he obviously has. But the important thing here is to keep in mind his vision of his father. Perfect, good, godlike, noble, upright, strong, heroic, Herculean. And now he's walking the battlements and he's in arms. Ooh, this is, I knew it. End of the scene, Act 1, Scene 2. My father's spirit in arms, all is not well. I doubt some foul play. Something has gone on. Well, he's onto it. He's right. Something has gone on. Would the night were come. Till then sit still, my soul. He's talking about his soul. The soul is there. Foul deeds will rise, though all the earth o'erwhelm them to men's eyes. End of scene. It's wonderful. Now, the reason I'm jumping ahead, please look at the opening of scene 3. The scene between brother and sister. Laertes, my necessaries are embarked, farewell, and sister, as the winds give benefit, and convoy is assistant, do not sleep, but let me hear from you. Do you doubt that? For Hamlet, and the trifling of his favor, hold it a fashion, a toy in blood, a violet in the youth of primy nature, forward, not permanent, sweet, not lasting, the perfume and suppliance of a minute, no more. What is Laertes saying to his sister Ophelia? Hamlet doesn't love you, it's just appetite. We get in the very next scene the continuation of that major theme, which is, there isn't love, there's only desire and appetite. We get the brother saying to the sister, don't believe in his words of love. That's not real. Doubt it. Doubt it. It's not accurate. Notice Ophelia's response. Ah, breaks your heart. No more but so. She's being polite. She's being respectful. She's being quiet. But the question is, that's all it is? Think it no more. And then Laertes goes into a long speech, okay? In which he says, no, he's not for you, he doesn't care for you, even if he did, it wouldn't be appropriate. He hammers it at her. And then it's beautiful. She turns it back on him saying, well, okay, I'll listen to you, but you better follow the same advice yourself. You keep yourself removed too. It's very lovely. And, do not, as some ungracious pastors do, show me the steep and thorny way to heaven, whilst like a puffed and reckless libertine, himself the primrose path of dalliance treads and wrecks not his own reed. Primrose path is wonderful, but please notice the floral garden imagery again. But here we've got flowers, and they are ordered along a pathway. It's a primrose path. Oh, fear me not, I stay too long. Polonius comes in. I've just got a few minutes here. I just have to make a couple of quick points. We get the famous advice to the son. It's wonderful. You'll hear it all the time. Some of the most famous lines quoted from this play are, you know, and to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Which is lovely and nice and shows up in Hallmark cards, and we give it to Grandma, and she has a little chill and a little tear in her eye, and we all feel good. And it is one of my favorite examples. You can never, ever say, Shakespeare says. These words are coming from Polonius. He is a spy. He is a liar. He is untrustworthy. Polonius says this. And with these words, we have a problem. What about the advice he gives to his son? In fact, if we look at that, to thine own self be true. What does that mean? If you're a spy, be a good, true spy? What is it? You know, what do the words mean? Be very cautious of pulling Shakespeare out of context. That's Polonius. The words are those of Polonius. It can be very interesting to look at, interesting to analyze, but we've got a puzzle right here. Does the man mean it? And if he means it, what is he saying? And if he's saying it and meaning it, then what's he doing in Act 2, Scene 1, when he sends the spy off to spy on Laertes? Every single thing in this play is a problem or a question. But that's because the world that we're living in is indeed rotten. Denmark has become rotten. And what we're defining in the first act is the nature of that rottenness. And in that rotten world, how can you function? How can you believe anything? In fact, it's gotten so bad that in that world, the question is raised, can you even believe in love itself? That most basic and important glue that holds humanity together. Because if that doesn't exist, there is nothing. It gets emphasized again. Off goes Laertes, and Polonius turns to Ophelia and says, what was he talking to you about? You know, rat on your brother. Well, he told me not to believe in Lord Hamlet's love. And Polonius says, that's right. He just wants one thing from you. He's a young man. I know what young men are after. In few, Ophelia, do not believe his vows, for they are brokers, not of that dye which their investments show, but mere implorators of unholy suits, breathing like sanctified and pious bawds, the better to beguile. This is for all. I would not, in plain terms, from this time forth, have you so slander any moment leisure as to give words or talk with the Lord Hamlet. Look to it, I charge you, come your ways. I shall obey, my lord. What is she obeying between a young man and his hope bride? You obey that? Question. You obey a king? Question. Do you obey a mother who's to not mind whose arm she's hanging on? A mother who will remarry within a little month. What kind of obedience is owed? Is the against it boast? The burden of action has not yet been placed on Hamlet's shoulders, but the point I think Shakespeare is making is this world of Denmark is rotten. Forget about the ghost and his message. Look at what's just going on in human terms. And this raises serious questions. Very quickly. This afternoon, I'm going to go over that soliloquy metrically. I think we'll do it down here, yes? We'll gather here because we can maybe have a little more air. That was the thought. And I'm becoming increasingly fond of air in these recent days. As I melt, thaw, and resolve myself into a dew. And then tonight, we're hoping, because I didn't get to it this morning, we're going to have a long discussion of the ghost. The ghost is a central problem in the play, so we will gather tonight and we'll spend our night with this ghost and try to make his acquaintance. See you this afternoon at 3:00.